You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 3rd, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening.
Kara cannot join us this week because she is busy with some special class. So, but she'll be back next week. And we missed the live stream on Friday because
we had
too much going on. Evan, you're like hip deep in taxes.
Yeah. I'm definitely taking part of the blame for that one. Yeah, I am neck deep in it.
Plus, I had to wash my hair and stuff, you know.
Which one?
No, but, you know, Evan had to bail out the last minute, which we totally expect. Like, you know, there's like 2 to 3 months where Evan just has to be more on call, which, you know, it's fine. We don't, you know, it doesn't bother us.
It's these 6 weeks. It's March and the first 2 weeks of April is just, there's nothing else in my life other than, well, SGU and taxes and getting some sleep when I can. And really, that is it. I am not doing anything else.
Then it was my wife's 40th birthday, so like having both of us have to drop, you know, it would have been Bob and Steve, and then, you know, without Evan
I
and I there,
Steve,
what kind of
I
show would
Steve
it be?
Steve we could handle it. Steve and I could handle it. He disagreed.
Yeah, I disagreed. So in case you were worried, everything was fine. We just, you know, life intrudes. The Friday live stream has been fun, but it's still kind of, we're just doing it on a whim. You know what I mean? Like it's not really built into our schedule. Yeah, it's just.
If we can do it, we will do it.
It's a voluntary thing that we do. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised we've been this consistent, but I love it. It's a great, great kickoff for the weekend, you know?
You know, our intense conversations go back 30 years, you know? Right, Ev? How long have we known each other now, Ev?
1992 is when I met you guys.
Yes. Whoa, yeah. 92?
April of 92.
Coming up on 30 years.
But
damn, yep, baby.
The fact Amazing. That we do a three-hour recording on Wednesday nights with each other, and then we jump on a live stream and just
for an hour and a half.
Yeah, shoot the breeze for another hour and a half like it's nothing. Like, oh my God, I just the wonderful thing about having people like this is you never run out of conversation.
I mean, we did the 12-hour show and it didn't seem like 12 hours to me.
No,
we
were scratching the surface.
We over-prepared like we normally do, but even that. It really, we could have, I think, easily gone another 12 hours.
Easily, because we did less than half of what we prepared.
That's the good thing about doing a science show is that there's always science, right? The science is always changing, always new stuff to talk about. And speaking of which, we're just going to get right to our news items. We have a lot to get through, actually. Jay, you're going to start by talking about MOXIE.
So NASA, for the very first time, is going to try to use something outside of Earth as a resource. I briefly mentioned this instrument last week, you know, when I was talking about the Perseverance Mars rover, and it contains... Yeah. The rover contains a new instrument that potentially could be one of the most profound events of the mission. And it's called MOXIE, as Steve keeps like, he likes, just loves the word, right? Don't you, Steve?
Sure.
It'd be a really cute nickname for a girlfriend, you know? It's a really cool word. So if successful, this mission will prove to be the beginning of being able to send astronauts home from Mars and also, in part, keep them alive. Now, I'm being vague deliberately because I'm filling your brain with secondary information and then you'll see what I do. So at the size of a car battery, this gold-colored prototype requires how much energy, guys?
Three.
One-third of the rover's energy. One-third of Perseverance's energy.
Gigawatts?
Is going to this part. Now, like I said, this is not part of the rover's primary mission. And when it performs its function, it's going to run at 800 degrees Celsius or 1,472 degrees Fahrenheit. Guys, this
Don't touch
is
it.
So incredibly hot that the engineers had to use the best insulating material known to man to protect Perseverance from it. MOXIE stands for Mars Oxygen In Situ Resource Utilization Experiment. So its function is actually similar to that of a tree in that it will intake carbon dioxide, which there's plenty of because the Mars atmosphere is literally CO2. That is the atmosphere of Mars. So after its process is done, it'll output pure oxygen into the Martian atmosphere. And this is not for terraforming purposes. Although, my God, Bob, how cool would that be if we started terraforming Mars in the next 30 years? Like, just try to change the atmosphere of Mars.
Send up a billion MOXIEs.
Blue skies
not
going to
happen.
Yeah.
So, Jay, where does the carbon go?
I'm going to tell you everything, Steve, but in my own way, in my way. Okay. So on future missions, the oxygen would be used for what? For fuel and breathing, That's, you know, that's what oxygen is perfect for. So clearly future astronauts will be depending on the future versions of MOXIE. So like I said, the Martian atmosphere, it's 100 times less dense than Earth's. And that, you know, that doesn't mean that there isn't a huge abundance of CO2, because that's what it is. That's all the air that's there is CO2. And NASA plans on turning MOXIE on about 12 times during the next two Earth years. And that should do it. That should be enough for engineers to be able to suss it all out. So what they're predicting is that it will produce between 6 and 10 grams of oxygen per hour. And that is enough oxygen to keep a small mammal like a skunk or a fox, or 22 lowland streaked tenrics. Look it up. They're really cute.
What the hell?
Just look them up. They're cute as hell.
22 of
them. Yep. Just going by body weight, Ev. We're testing it now to see if it successfully functions on Mars. Now, why couldn't they just test it on Earth? Well, the fact is, we did. But you have to keep in mind that Mars is dusty. It's very cold. Minus 62 Celsius and minus 81 Fahrenheit. There's no predicting the ways that this thing can fail, like any other device. So that's why we want to bring it to Mars and test it there. So, you know, when they turn it on for the first time, they're expecting that it's going to function, but you got to keep a couple of other things in mind. That one, Mars has dramatic temperature changes. The conditions can widely change just when the sun sets. It can go down to minus 101 Celsius or negative 150 Fahrenheit. That's cold. Oh, and, yeah. You know, this absolutely traumatic temperature change, you know, changes the density of the atmosphere. You know, you could do this test on your own. You know, if you ever put a balloon in a freezer, it shrinks. You know, that's what the atmosphere does when it gets cold. So depending on the season on Mars, you know, much of the atmosphere turns into dry ice. Actually, during the Martian winter, it literally falls from the sky as dry ice crystals at the poles. So that's pretty, it's pretty great, you know, that we have this device that we're going to test. And we're like, okay, let's throw Mars at it and see if it works. In the future, a MOXIE device would have to be able to produce hundreds of times more oxygen. Of course, because why? Because we're just testing this tiny little prototype. But in order for it to really create fuel, like just, let's say we just want to like send a ship that we land that brought people. You know, this is all a guesstimation, but it would have to run, the larger version of this machine would have to run nonstop for a year to make enough oxygen to get a ship off of Mars. So that's one of these devices at size, you know, 100 times bigger mm-hmm. than the current one. Hundreds of times bigger, mm-hmm. by the way. So it pulls in Martian atmosphere through a filter and it pressurizes it to one atmosphere. And then the pressurized CO2 is then fed to a solid oxide electrolyzer where it electromagnetically changes the molecules at the cathode, right? So the engineers say that this is equal to running a fuel cell in reverse, by the way. But the heat and the electricity split the CO2 molecule.
Yeah, one interesting tidbit, Jay, is that it splits the CO2 into oxygen, but also carbon monoxide, CO. And that's a high energy molecule that can be used as a precursor to make things like jet fuel, you know, which could be handy to have on Mars for, you know, backup generators, if nothing else.
So another significant goal here is how to best run MOXIE itself. It's not as simple as just, you know, you're not just turning it on like a light. It's this really incredibly nuanced series of events that needs to take place. If the heat and the electrical charge are not strong enough, CO2 molecules will make it through the machine. And if they run it too weak, then the machine is going to be stripping off too many oxygen molecules. And if that happens, it'll create a lot of carbon atoms. And carbon atoms would kill the machine because it would fill it with soot. And this is also known as coking. So NASA will fine-tune MOXIE literally by hand now, you know, of course, via radio signal by hand. So they'll be turning the knobs to make sure that they're bringing in a certain amount of O2, of CO2, and the heat is correct and the electrical charge is correct. And that's how basically it works. I mean, it's using those two things to split up the CO2 molecule to get to the oxygen. At the very end of this machine, we will get oxygen and carbon monoxide, and it's going to push both of those two gases into the Martian atmosphere. Now, again, this is insignificant. It's not going to do anything on a big scale. But on a small scale, if we collect the oxygen, you know, that's just as important as water. So let's think about this. NASA is testing a device that can literally prepare Mars for humans to go to Mars. right? We'll drop one of these, you know, 1, 10, 20 of the big ones down. I have no idea how many that they're going to want to drop, but they'll get these devices to Mars. They'll probably have storage tanks that are already there to start the process, or they'll start doing the collection when the astronauts get there. I'd hope that some of this stuff would already be in place. Interestingly, there is a division at NASA, and its goal is to advance human exploration. So they have four questions that they need answered. They need to know all the details about Martian radiation. They also need to know about how to land a heavy spacecraft on Mars, which we have not done. They need to know all the ways that dust can interfere with equipment. And they need to figure out ways to take advantage of raw materials on Mars so that will lighten the load of payload, right? We don't want to send oxygen to Mars when we can make it on Mars. We don't want to send water to Mars if we can collect water on Mars. So, you know, that's their job to figure all of those things out, the resources that are there that we can transform. Making oxygen on Mars, guys, is an absolute requirement in order for crewed missions to begin, right? Of course. You can't ship it all there. So if things go well and enough data is gathered from this prototype, NASA, you know, they might be sending a fully scaled MOXIE on a future mission not too soon from now. NASA is indeed already testing a larger prototype right now that can create more than 2 pounds of oxygen per hour. That's not bad.
And what's the energy source for those devices going to be? Just solar? It's going to be like just solar powered?
Right now, it's the onboard energy that Perseverance has in solar collection. But they were saying that there has to be some type of reactor that they send there for electricity. I mean,
sure.
You can't just collect solar on Mars. They're going to want some type of nuclear
You could if you
reactor.
Have a year. You know, if you have years to do it, doesn't matter.
Sure. But, you know, I think having an instant source of energy is a hugely important thing when you have people living on Mars. You can't like solely, you know, use solar radiation and batteries. Like you're going to want something that's going to always be pumping out electricity. So
yeah, use some source with the radioactive decay.
Yep, nuclear.
So, you know, I love this one because it's in the works. This is happening now. This is not happening in 10 years. This is literally on Mars right now. They're going to turn it on. It's going to spit out oxygen. You know, fingers crossed, but it's very likely to happen because they've already tested the hell out of it.
So they are signaling, I mean, NASA, among others, that this is manned missions to Mars in the future, and that I suppose they feel that robotics will only ever get us so far. Otherwise, they would be making more, perhaps, investments in expanding the robotics of it all.
I mean, I think they're going down both routes. I mean, we're sending super complicated billion-dollar robots to Mars, right? So we are sending robotics there. I mean, the idea, like, and let me just extrapolate, I think, on what you're saying, Ev. Like, imagine if we take, like, a Boston Dynamics robot, a future version of one of them, or send, you know, 20 of them to Mars and have them start building living quarters, you know, living habitats, have them start putting together machinery and all that. Well, yeah, that would be fantastic. But this is a clear sign that NASA is saying, and they are saying 25 to 30 years, you know, like that's their target number of where they want to prepare the Mars infrastructure so they could do it. And this is one quarter of the huge unanswered questions that could be answered. You know, if this machine works and they have, you know, a better version of it. And they're also talking about having the future versions of it be solely run by AI because it needs to be tweaked as it goes. This isn't like
AI, baby.
Yeah, it's not going to be. This machine needs to be like completely monitored and fully, you know, tweaked as it's running. You know, it can't be like, oh, it didn't do this right. You know, it has to happen on the fly. So AI is definitely the solution here. So as long as it doesn't become conscious and then reprogram those Boston Dynamics robots and then they build a whole Mars colony that, you know, in 15 years comes and kills us, it's going to be awesome. No, but I am riveted to the Perseverance mission, and especially like this MOXIE thing has totally piqued my interest and curiosity. It's wonderful to think that oxygen is going to slowly trickle out onto Mars. Just totally is fantastic. It's given me the, what do you call it, Ev?
The heebie-jeebies.
Well, it's more like it made me feel like I did when I was like 15 learning about. Yeah, like just, yeah, my nuts. No, but you know, when you were a young kid and you started to get into space and you had that like romantic feeling about space and space travel, like it made me feel that again. Yeah.
So don't underestimate, though, the value of the carbon monoxide that gets produced also. So carbon monoxide is a very high energy molecule. You combine that with hydrogen and you have jet fuel. You know, yep. You can have a hydrocarbon. Oh, yeah. And so this could be making oxygen to store in, you know, in tanks, and then also be, if they want to, you know, they might have to electrolyze water to get more oxygen. Then they have the hydrogen. They combine that with the carbon monoxide. They have jet fuel. And now you have fuel and oxygen to combine with that fuel to burn it. The oxygen would also bootstrap any habitats until they're growing enough plant life to generate. Then once they get the plant life going in the habitats, that will make more oxygen than they need just to breathe. Yeah. But yeah, this is really about the fuel. You obviously don't want to bring the fuel with you to Mars that you need to get back. Because of the whole fuel equation, you know, the rocket equation. You want to be able to go there, land pretty much on empty, and then just pick up your fuel for the return trip. That would be ideal.
You know, we take everything for granted on Earth, you know, and this is where, like, following what NASA is doing. You know, they don't. NASA completely gets it, you know, and they're saying, we have to develop a machine that can do this. And they did. And I just find that so perfectly human, you know, like the innovation of humankind is so fantastic. There is a toaster-sized, battery-sized machine on Mars that is converting the Martian atmosphere into oxygen. Oh my God.
It's got to run on solar, I think. It's got to run on solar. I mean, unless they're going to send a self-contained nuclear reactor or something to Mars, I don't think they're going to do. And I don't think the atmosphere is thick enough for wind turbines to be very efficient.
They could send some of the newly designed nuclear reactors, Steve. The ones that they got like 10 kilowatts for like one of those things. They're not very big. I don't know how automated it is to actually set it up. I mean, how much human help do you need to set it up? But 10 kilowatts, man, that's pretty decent. You daisy chain a bunch of them together. You got plenty of power.
And yeah, maybe that would be the power source for that. Astronauts too, you know, they send
yeah, oh, absolutely, reactors. That's what it's designed for. That's what it's designed for. Outposts like on the moon, eventually even Mars, and in my backyard.
Solar collection on Mars takes longer because
it's farther away. Oh, sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not as much power. All right, let's move on. So, not too long ago, I talked about the extinction of the megafauna in North America, and now, not too long after that, there was another news item talking about just the megafauna extinction worldwide. And coming back to this question of how much is human activity responsible for the extinction of megafauna in general? Hmm. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's true in every single time and place, and maybe North America was an exception or not. You know, again, that's still controversial. But the authors here did a very interesting thing. They took an approach that was very reductionist, which I always love. They just said, let's just look at the amount of energy you would have to expend in hunting and the amount of calories you would get back for your effort. Like, how much calorie bang for the buck are you getting in hunting? And, you know, by their calculations, the bigger the animal you hunt, the more energy efficient it is.
Sure.
Right?
And the more friends that die.
So, well, if you get, once you get to the point where you have tools, like you can make spear points that are big enough to kill a large mammal.
Ranged weapons, yeah.
And especially if they're ranged and you have enough intelligence to hunt cooperatively. Like once you get tip over that point where you could reliably take down big game, then that becomes what you're doing. Now, I also will note just archaeologically that this also coincides with using fire to cook. You know, the oldest evidence of cooking fires. And this is in Homo erectus. So at some point, Homo erectus started hunting big game and cooking their food. And when they did that, they spread throughout the world. And that they were the first, you know, human ancestor to really do that. Probably partly because if you're going to be hunting big game, you need a large territory, right? Everybody can't be doing it in the same place. And so, but there's pressure to keep spreading out, and they just spread throughout the world.
Fun times.
At the same time, you know, starting around that time, you know, there's also been a consistent trend in the fossil record among mammals of decreasing average size. And it's been pretty consistent. Pretty much wherever people go, animals get smaller. And that correlation is pretty robust in the fossil record. And so what the new authors are saying is that the human the overkill hypothesis, right? Human pressure from hunting was a consistent selective pressure against large body size. And so animals, you know, the bigger animals were dying off, basically.
Makes sense.
And you know, and the other thing is, like, you don't have to, like, kill every last member of a species in order to drive it to extinction. Just adding adding that pressure, adding that selective pressure, you know, stresses out species and just reduces their life expectancy, right? Their species lifetime, right? And you, generally speaking, you know, biologists believe that once a population gets to less than 2,000, it's pretty much going to go extinct. Like that, the probability of going extinct approaches 100, you know, as you get less than 2,000 individuals. A genetically healthy, sustainable population is minimum about 2,000. So anyway, you isolate these populations, you reduce their numbers, you put the selective pressure on them, and then the big species start going extinct. So what does this mean? This means that humans have to hunt smaller and smaller animals. They say
that's right.
This correlates with a dramatic increase in human brain size because it takes a lot more brain power to hunt small game than large
game. Cool. Yeah.
It's
interesting.
Yeah, so to find they're
faster, they're harder. Yeah, you may have to do trapping or more elaborate kind of procedures in order to get them. Whereas a big lumbering elephant, you just need, you know, the big weapons
brute force,
and a lot of people, you know, it's more brute force. Perhaps, you know, than real skill and cleverness. But then they said they by their calculations, as animals get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller from hunting pressure, at some point it's no longer worth it. Like at some point you have to spend more energy hunting than you get out of the food you catch.
Yeah, like when you start hunting bacteria.
Yeah.
Well,
no, but fishing is that. Fishing could be like that. You know, if you're spending all day fishing, you know, one or two fish does not have a lot of calories in it.
Yeah, right. Until you get more modern techniques. So,
yeah, nets
so
and
then
stuff.
They argue this is kind of like a little bit of a one explanation for a lot of things happening. I'm always suspicious of those, but they argue that when the human civilization in general got to that point where we were getting diminishing returns on hunting because we were driving the bigger species into extinction, that is the point when we switched over to agriculture and husbandry, where we started raising animals, domesticating animals, and growing crops, because hunting was no longer sustainable for humans because we just killed all the big animals, basically.
So you're not happy with the connection they made there?
No, I just think it's a little simplistic, but it's probably not the whole story. There's a lot of complexity there, but the general idea of the diminishing returns of calories for effort as bigger animals decrease is a reason. I like that reasoning. I think it's probably a factor. Is that the only reason why we picked up agriculture 14,000 years ago? Probably not. But I mean, it may have been a contributing factor.
So if dinosaurs were around, we never would have gotten smart?
Well, probably not, but for other reasons. Yeah, it's interesting. So the thing is, if you look at the fossil evidence, again, this is still a little controversial. This is not universally accepted among paleontologists. But the evidence, I reviewed the evidence just as part of looking at this story. Say, where are we with this overkill hypothesis globally? It seems to be pretty solid, and it sounds like it's, if anything, growing in popularity. So, for example, like in North America, we go back to North America. The average body size, the average weight of a mammal decreased from 216 pounds to just 17 pounds.
Wow.
And also you could look at it as, what is the probability in the fossil record of a large species going extinct? It's between 100 and 1,000 times greater than the smaller species, the smaller mammals. Yeah, there's basically a dramatic orders of magnitude decrease in the average body size of mammals. If you look at any continent, over the last 125,000 years, definitely maybe 1 to 2 million years, there's this consistent trend. Now, if you look at an alternative hypothesis, which scientists like to do, say, well, what if climate was killing off the bigger species because they didn't have enough food or whatever to eat. The vegetation wasn't supporting bigger body size. And humans mm-hmm. were just hunting what was there. You know, they were just following this trend, not driving the trend. So what they looked at is the correlation between climate and body size of mammals. And mm-hmm. you know what they found?
What?
Nothing. No correlation. Animals do not tend to get bigger or smaller because the average temperature is going up or going down. So absent the presence of humans, the climate does not have this same effect, does not reduce body size over time. There's no correlation. So, you know, it's looking pretty good for humans being the decisive factor in killing off the megafauna, you know?
Makes total sense to me.
Yeah. And it's not just by hunting, by the way. Hunting, you think of hunting, again, that's sort of the simplistic notion. It's hunting, but it's also changing the habitat.
That's right. You know? Yeah, driving them out of the where they're able to breed and
or
reproduce and everything.
Burning down the forest so you can grow the plants that you like. I mean, you know, that was not uncommon. Or just diverting water to your own use. I mean, there's lots of ways in which humans change the environment, adding further pressures. You know, you can also carry this forward from 14,000 years ago, you know, or 12,000 or so years ago when the advent of agriculture to the present. And in fact, you know, humans affecting the habitat of animals has been getting much, much worse. So we've basically taken over half of the land, you know, the ice-covered land on the planet to grow our own food and for our own, you know, habitat. So, you know, the background extinction rate, just if you look at just the history of the world, there's a pretty steady background extinction rate, and it's about one species per million species per year, which makes sense. I mean, species, you know, on average live about 1 to 2 million years. So one species per million species per year go extinct as the background rate. There's about 10 million, you know, rounding it off, 10 million species on the planet. So we would expect 10 species to go extinct every year, just evolutionarily as the background rate. What do you think the current observed rate of extinctions are?
I don't even know.
A couple of orders of magnitude.
Times 1,000.
30,000 per year.
Whoa.
Oh, my God.
We are so good at destroying things. Oh,
from
my God.
10 per year to 30,000. And that's mostly habitat loss, but now we could throw in climate change as well. Diversion of resources. Most calories in the world now are going to humans. Most fresh water is going to humans. You know, so of course, that's going to be a huge pressure on every other animal.
Oh my gosh, right.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we take it away and they will suffer.
Many scientists, that's why they call what's happening right now the sixth mass extinction.
Yeah.
Right.
If you just look based upon the extinction rate, you can imagine far future paleontologists looking at the fossil record, like, something happened here. You know, a lot of species went extinct over this period of time.
We are a blight.
Steve, do we have any information about ocean dwelling creatures and how we're and the impact we're having on that?
Yeah, it's really bad as well. This research was focusing on land mammals specifically, but yeah, I mean it's also true of the ocean as well. So, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't like to think of humanity as a blight or a disease or an infestation or whatever. That's a very negative view. Uh-huh. People do what we do, right? This is the way we evolve. This is how we develop. These are the strategies we develop to survive.
Right. And murder hornets do what they do.
Yeah, murder hornets do what they do. People are doing what they do. But I do think, you know, we are a species that can pick our head up and go, huh, should we be doing this? You know, is this in our long-term best interest? Is this the way we want to change the world?
Yeah.
You know?
We'll do that when murder hornets do it.
No, I mean, I think you're even underplaying man's awareness. Like, we know what's going on.
No, I'm not. I'm saying we as a species, we have a tremendous amount of power to alter the planet, but we also have the awareness to think about what we want to do and whether it's right or whether it's in our own interest, even long term. And just, it's hard. Marshaling the political will to change what we're doing is proving to be impossible, really,
futile.
Really difficult. Yeah. So, but, you know, I think that, again, we did the forces of within our civilization who have the awareness and the will and whatever to think carefully, and mainly scientists, I have to say, who want to look around and say, we probably shouldn't destroy our environment and, you know, dramatically change the climate and, you know, be so resource intensive in everything that we do if we want to have, if we want to preserve the natural world, which I think we do. I certainly do. I, you know, think nature is wonderful and would love to preserve it as much as possible.
And if you polled people of that question, regardless of political affiliation or anything else, I believe you'd see a majority of people agree with
that. It's true, Evan. I've absolutely seen multiple different surveys where they ask people, do you want to prevent climate change? Do you want to preserve habitats? And do you want to, you know, prevent species from going extinct? And everybody says yes. And then you ask them, would you do this one sacrifice to do it? And they say no. And so it's like everyone wants to do it as long as they don't personally have to make a sacrifice. So that's why we keep doing what we're doing. But if we look for, if we, you know, again, we don't necessarily have to make big self-sacrifices. We may be able to just do things a lot smarter than we are, right? Like, yeah, we could use all the energy we're using, but let's just do as much green energy as possible. You know, like, for example, you don't have to not use energy. Let's just use energy that has a smaller footprint on this planet. And yeah, we should grow the food we need to grow, but we could do it with 20% less land than we're currently using. Then let's do that, you know. Whatever, there's like all kinds of things. We could just do things smarter. And I don't think we're, you know, with approaching 8 billion people on this planet, we just don't have the room anymore than we used to. We need to be smarter about how, you know, our footprint on this planet if we want to keep it a good place to live. You know, there's no other place out there. Even as much as exciting as Mars is, Mars really sucks compared to the Earth. I mean, it is very inhospitable. There is no place we know of in this universe that is anywhere near as hospitable as Earth. And we, you know, it's also really hard to get anywhere else. So
yeah, that's going to be the biggest problem.
Yeah, I know. Just this is kind of a Carl Sagan kind of a thought to have. It's like, yeah, so we just better take care of this one planet that we have, which we're not doing. The bottom line is we're not doing it.
Nope. We're bad stewards.
Yeah, totally.
Damn you, Patrick. Right.
And, Bob, to top it all off, Earth is losing its own oxygen atmosphere.
Come on.
What?
Yeah, it's true. It seems that way anyway. NASA researchers have run simulations recently that showed the oxygen in Earth's atmosphere could be gone in, guess, how many years? Steve, you probably read the exact.
Yeah. I read it too.
Gosh. Earth loses its oxygen?
Quintillion years. How many years?
Well.
How many years? Come on, people.
I know the answer. Well, I don't want to say it.
All right. Too long, a billion years. A billion years, you know, seems like a long time, but, you know, don't continue putting stuff off because, you know, it's happening. So this is from researchers from Toho University and NASA Nexus for Exoplanet System Science. I like the sound of that. They published a paper in the journal Nature Geoscience, and this is Kazumi Ozaki and Christopher Reinhardt. So now we think of the Earth as an oxygen-rich world, and it is, and it has been for a while, but it wasn't always such, and it won't always be. There was an event in Earth's history called the Great Oxygenation Event, and this started about 2.5 billion years ago with the cyanobacteria producing molecular oxygen. For the first time, you've got this being produced, and that, of course, eventually gave rise to multicellular life that then took advantage of the oxygen, because oxygen is awesome. It's extremely reactive. It can form compounds with most of the stuff on the periodic table and release energy when it does it. It's just wonderful.
I like it. Do you like it?
Yeah, right? I love it, man. Such an occurrence seems to like absolutely require a really grand name, right? Like the Great Oxygenation Event. That sounds like a good name for that. The other common names, though, that I came across for it are awesome, because they reflect a perspective that seems to come from the losing side of the Great Oxygenation Event. You know, the ones that don't write the history, namely those organisms for which oxygen was poison. And there were plenty of anaerobic oxygens that were poisoned by this oxygen and died out. So the other names for the Great Oxygenation Event that I came across are the Oxygen Revolution, the Oxygen Catastrophe, which I like, the Oxygen Crisis, and even the Oxygen Holocaust. cost.
Oh, gosh.
That one seems a little bit extreme. but still, you know, so yeah, so it depends how you look at it, right? Because this was a world-changing event, you know, that did take time. Now the level of this killer oxygen was probably small for a long, long time. So long, in fact, that some people think that it's only in the past 400 million years with the rise of land plants that oxygen reached the levels that we have today. In fact, for a while, though, it was actually greater, right, Steve? It was instead of 23 or 24%, it's like, what, 28% or so?
No, I think it's 21, it was 24.
Okay. And that's why back then they had gargantuan bugs. Like they had like dragonflies that were like many times bigger than anything we have today. That must have been really cool to see. So it's easy to think then that that oxygen won out, right? Oxygen won. And it's going to stay that way until the sun just like expands and burns us to a crisp. That's not really...
That's 5 billion years.
Yeah, 5 billion
now,
years, right? Because that's how much longer the sun's got. But that's not true. It's going to be a lot sooner than that. But it's hard to pin down, you know, a really solid time frame in the deep future when Earth's oxygen levels are going to suffer an event one way or the other, you know, worthy of, you know, putting down the event in your Google Calendar. And so this is what the two researchers were trying to determine. You know, when is this, what's going to happen and when? So they did this by combining biogeochemistry and a climate model to make an interesting simulation of the Earth. So they ran this simulation about 400,000 times, which, oh boy, I'm hoping that was automated. But my guess is that they had a lot of free time in the pandemic. So they ran it 400,000 times, of course, tweaking and changing parameters here and there just to, you know, because you can't know for certain what every parameter needs to be for a perfect simulation, of course. So you change the parameters to what's, you know, for all the reasonable settings just to get a broad idea of what the range of possibility is with higher confidence. So once they did all that, their big picture conclusion was that Earth will lose most of its oxygen in its atmosphere fairly quickly within a billion years, give or take a few weeks. Give or take 140 million years, one way or the other.
That can be expressed in weeks.
Yes.
Sure.
And this pretty much, and of course, it ultimately does. This is going to happen because of the sun. Damn you, soul. The intense heat on the Earth, though, is what's going to cause this to happen because the sun is going to expand. It's going to get a lot harder in town, and it just basically starts a chain reaction of really nasty events, each of them probably deserving their own grand name. So first you have the carbon dioxide levels will go down, and that's because the heat, the carbon dioxide will absorb this greater heat, and it's going to actually cause it to break down.
Oh, finally, a solution for global
warming. There you go. And then the warmer the air, the more that certain rocks like limestone, chemical weathering happens, and it pulls in more amounts of the oxygen in the atmosphere. So basically taking out oxygen in the atmosphere, that's going to increase. And then the upper atmosphere is going to change, right? Because the upper atmosphere is now absorbing all of this heat energy from the sun. So that will increase the kinetic energy of the atoms and molecules in the upper atmosphere. And because oxygen molecules are lightweight, they are just going to dart off into space as they get increased kinetic energy. So we're going to lose oxygen that way as well. And then kind of the other side of the coin here, you've got the heavier molecules like methane. They're going to stick around because they're not going to get enough kinetic energy to leave the planet. So they're going to be relatively more abundant as time goes on. So all this is happening. But the coup de grace, though, is really the decrease in carbon dioxide. Because of that, algae and land plants will start feeling the pain. They're going to start feeling it, and they're going to reduce oxygen production. Not good. It's already decreasing, right? So then you're going to start reducing this free oxygen production, which is really the only source of it in the world, is this algae and land plants. So they calculated that over 10,000 years, carbon dioxide levels will go so low that the plants will die off. 10,000 years, no more plants, you know, in a billion years, you know, but the interval where it gets real bad is going to be relatively brief. And then, of course, with the plants gone, the animals, you know, the plant eaters are going to go. And then the animals that eat the plant eaters, they're going to go. Not good.
That's a chain reaction, right?
So this is what they're talking about. This is, you know, this is going to be very similar to the early Earth when you know, when it was just like it's going to be like methane and nitrogen and some other nasty gases that are, you know, inimical to aerobic life. So it's going to be bad. It's going to be like early Earth. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? Why did science fiction movies so accurately predict all this crap?
Why did they?
Yeah, like it's like I've seen this movie. You know what I mean? Like let's get to the fix already.
Yeah. There's not going to be any suggested fixes here, Jerry. Although maybe we can discuss them when I'm done. I've only got two more sentences. So I'm sure that we're going to have a good name for this. We're going to probably call this the Greatly Egregious Deoxygenation Catastrophe. We're going to come up with something really grand, assuming, of course, we're even alive, which we won't be in a billion years. Nothing human-like anyway. But I think, though, that in a couple billion years, though, if complex anaerobic life somehow develops, don't bet any money on it, but if it somehow develops, they will call it the Great Methanogenation Event. They'll come up with a really nice word. So enjoy the oxygen while you can.
Bob, they won't have lips to even talk with. You know,
who knows what they'll have? They'll express it in some sort
electromagnetic
signals. Way. They'll be breathing methane in and out, or nitrogen, or something else. Interesting, though. So, yeah, you think, oh, we got 5 billion more years left because that's when the sun is going to get really nasty. Like, no, things are going to get worse. And I've heard estimates that say it's going to get pretty bad even well before that, too. So I've heard numbers like in the hundreds of millions of years.
Scientists also predict that, you know, with the sun getting warmer and also the oceans, you know, as the subduction zones, they actually get dragged down underneath the crust, that in 1.1 billion years, the oceans will be gone.
Yep.
So there won't
be any free water on the surface, and that's when, you know, that's when life was really going to have a hard time.
Yeah.
You know, but we kind of started with bacteria and archaea, and we're going to probably end that way. It'd be cool though to see what kind of archaea and bacteria develop over, you know, with another couple billion years of evolution. It's going to be all theirs again, all theirs.
I mean, are we already just accepting the fact that humans are going to be dead? I mean, it's all very dark to me.
Well, I mean, the average lifespan of a species is, what, 2-3 million years. So if you go by averages, we're not going to last that long. But plenty of species lasted far longer than that. But we're a wild card, Jay. You know, we're a wild card. Who knows? If we start spreading throughout the solar system and then our area of the galaxy, you know, we could last for millions of years or we could be gone in a few weeks. Who the hell knows?
Oh, my God.
Who really knows?
Steve, what do you have to say about all this?
Well, sometimes you have to know when just to end the conversation.
Okay.
Very good.
Right, Evan?
Well, nice segue, Steve. Nice.
Scientifically speaking, yes. Have you ever been, I'm asking you guys, have you ever been in a conversation and you want for it to end, but you can't really find a good way to end it?
Yeah.
I think we've. Safe to say we've perhaps all been in that.
Sure,
place.
I just say, can't hear you, static.
See how COVID you are? My God, people used to be in, you know, face-to-face.
What's that mean?
Right. Remember that, Bob, back in 2019?
No. I've expunged it from my mind.
Those were the days. When you engage in conversation with another person, we are talking face-to-face, although we are also talking in other means as well, which I'll get to. But sometimes, you know, that other person in the conversation that you're talking to, they might speak too long. They might be, in fact, blathering.
Yeah.
Sometimes the other person is dull or boring. They just have very little to say that you find interesting. Or your mind maybe perhaps wanders to another topic. You see someone else across the room that maybe you'd rather be talking to at that moment. We've all been there,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Now, the unnecessary tangents and like unnecessary detail. That detail is not important. Please be more concise.
Exactly. Exactly. But Bob, on the other hand, that never happens to you, right? I mean, it's always the other person.
Of course.
Everything you say, Bob, is poignant. It's interesting. It's on topic. It's engaging. It's relevant.
By definition, I'm Bob.
Not so fast. The other person in the conversation that you're speaking with, when listening to the things that you have to say, they might find that you're the one speaking too long. Perhaps, Bob, you're blathering, or what you have to say
sacrilege.
Is boring. I know, that never happens to ourselves, right?
Right.
But there's even something that's more powerful, I'd say, than disinterested participants in a conversation. And that's a force of social nature that sort of overtakes our ability to end a conversation. Most people do not want to come off as impolite by ending a conversation that has not reached a natural conclusion. And there are many social cues that people give off, letting others know when the conversation has run its course.
Yep.
Now, culturally speaking, at least in America, which is my frame of reference, it's considered rude. If I were to, in the middle of conversation, and I don't want this to go on anymore, I would say, yeah, that's whatever you were talking about for you. Or even worse, what if I would say, oh, that's interesting. I have to go away now.
Yeah.
And but Jay, perhaps Dieter from Saturday Night Live Sprockets said it plainly and most directly when he would say to his talk show guests, you've grown tiresome.
Oh, my God.
Cutting them
oh
off God. In the middle of whatever it was they were talking about. And then, of course, there's the other end of the spectrum where you've experienced conversations that seem to end prematurely. And perhaps that's left us feeling dissatisfied or maybe even a little bit hurt inside. Well, a scientific paper, which has been 5 years in the making, has sort of confirmed our fears that people often feel trapped in conversation with the feeling of no easy way to end a conversation when they want it to end. The paper appeared in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Lead researcher Adam Mastriani and his team. They began the research when he was studying for his master's degree at Oxford, and he's now a PhD student in psychology at Harvard University. He and his colleagues invited groups of strangers, 252 of them specifically, into their laboratory, and they paired them up, pairs of people, one-on-one, for a chat. And they were allowed to chat as long as they wanted for at least 1 minute and a maximum of 45 minutes. And the volunteers, they were told that they didn't have to spend the full time on the conversation, that they could, you know, pretty much do what they want, talk about what you want for as long as you want. So the people were paired up. The idle chit-chat began. You know, they were talking about things like, well, where'd you grow up or what they were studying. So apparently a lot of these people were other students to some degree. A lot of the conversations, according to the researchers, were so boring that it became hard to watch them. So if you're a third person observing these conversations and you think it's boring, you know, who knows what the people in the conversation are thinking. So afterwards, the researchers asked the participants, how did they gauge their experience? So of 126 conversations that occurred, 2% ended when both parties wanted them to end. 2%. And this figure is remarkably stable, they said. Irrespective of whether you're talking to a stranger or someone you're familiar with. Now, the authors of the study believe that this discrepancy is the result of a coordination problem, it's called, arising because people tend to hide their true desires, including when they want a conversation to end, and it's an effort to avoid being rude. The results suggest that many conversations overrun for the sake of politeness and social solidarity, reaching a compromise that may suit neither party, but which crucially and admirably avoids offense. So think about it this way. According to the study, 98% of our conversations end unskillfully, reaching an unsatisfying conclusion, either too early or too late for one or both parties.
Yeah.
I honestly don't feel that at all. I feel conversationally, I've gotten to the point where I can really shift the conversation comfortably where I need it to go. And I do agree with you, Ev, this is the research. I agree with the research that, you know, there's a lot of like unconscious things that happen and ways of talking, cadence, probably even the way you breathe and all that stuff that are completely unconscious cues that we give out and receive and all that.
Hundreds of cues. They said there's like a catalog of hundreds of social cues as part of the conversation phenomenon that takes place. They say it's extremely complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like we do it so unconsciously, you know, like I am not conscious of it. I know a lot of people are, but I'm not because my brain is already just making it happen on its own.
Yeah, absolutely.
From my perspective, and I sort of have come to understand this a little more since I've been doing tax work. And when I am sitting in my office and having a one-on-one conversation with a person about their taxes, I'm very aware of their mannerisms and their level of either comfortableness or uncomfortableness. And there is a lot of people who come into the office very uncomfortable. They hate this. It's like going to a dentist for them. They fidget. You can see it in their eyes. You can see it just in their mannerisms. They hate being there. It's way too mm-hmm. painful an experience for them. So I absolutely, definitely see it. And I try to modulate myself or, you know, change my behavior based on the signals that they are sending out. And I do try to not make things go unnecessarily long. I do try to limit their uncomfortableness.
Yeah, there's a lot of context there. Obviously, if you have an intimate relationship with somebody, you learn how to manage that better, right, than a cocktail party where you're just chatting with somebody you know very superficially. Or there are situations where there's a power differential or just there's some kind of structure in place. Like when I'm seeing a patient and it's time for the encounter to end, it ends, you know. But sometimes, you know, it does drag on, but there are mechanisms where you can just structurally end the encounter when it is mm-hmm. over, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I might say, all right, let's move on to the next item. And then we do.
That's exactly what they report, Steve. They say the words anyway and all right. Those are two very common anywho, yes. ways
I got one, guys.
Telegraph to people.
I got one of those transition words. Ready? Well.
Steve, they ran another experiment, in which they used a crowdsourcing platform, Mechanical Turk. I've never heard of it. And they surveyed 800.
Oh yeah, Mechanical Turk. It's a thing where it learns from each encounter.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's one where, like, think of any person, you know, living, dead, real, or fictitious, and it will ask you questions and then guess who that person is. And it's remarkably powerful. But that's because it's, you know, after it does it a million times, it gets really good at asking questions and predicting who you're thinking about.
They surveyed a bunch of people on that platform, and they say that a lot of people in that platform have conversations with family and friends. So there's the familiarity, and the numbers seem to hold true.
Mm-hmm.
They get similar results that the majority of people feel like the conversation ended too quickly or was too short, or in some ways it came to an unsatisfying conclusion for both parties.
Yeah, well, but you think about it, you know, what's the probability that you and the person you're talking to have exactly the same desire for the conversation to end at the same moment, right?
Hard to write.
If there's any difference, then both will, you know, it'll go on too long for one and too short for the other.
This is reportedly the first study to put numbers on how difficult it is for people to balance their own goals with what their conversational partners want. They say that the disconnect between what people wanted and what their partners thought they wanted is considered an important finding. So that's why this paper is being talked about a lot and getting a lot of news. And they said that the work is consistent with other prior research that suggests that people are generally less skilled than we might imagine at working out what other people think. So there's mm-hmm. your takeaway, trying to better gauge what other people are thinking.
Okay, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. What is it?
One ping only.
I got that one.
Two pings only.
Any guesses, guys?
Oh, I mean, the pings kind of reminded me of sonar in a way, but I doubt that's it. I don't know what that bubbling sort of noise was.
Yeah, well, it's funny. It's so funny, Ev, how like some people can key in on different aspects of the noises. And I get people that write in and they nail like one of the noises that's inside of a noisy, say mm-hmm. like those bubbles. Or, you know, a lot of people would guess like when there's background noises, people will pick out details that I didn't hear. I'm like, oh, you're right. There is a frog croaking in the background, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting that you said that. Well, okay. So first, before I get in, let me say that I made a mistake last week that I'm moderately embarrassed about. And I had a couple of people email me saying that I didn't get Ben Burtt's name correct. Now, Ben Burtt is the sound engineer who did all of the Star Wars sound effects, the lightsaber and all. It's Ben Burtt.
What did you say?
I confused Ben with Bill Burr, but I mixed their names. I said Ben Burr. I think that's, Bill Burr is the comedian. Ben Burtt is the sound engineer. And I mixed the two names and I said something like Ben Burr or whatever. So I'm sorry to fans of both of those people. I'm sorry to those people as individuals. And I hate myself. No, but the thing that I didn't like is that I didn't remember Ben Burtt's name off the top because he's, you know, I idolize his sound effects. I mean, he came up with R2-D2. R2-D2 is actually his voice.
Oh,
you know what
God.
I mean? Yeah. He voiced those vocalizations. So anyway, two different people, mixed them up. They're both great. And both associated with Star Wars, by the way.
Yeah.
Jay, you lose one geek point.
I know. Steve,
I officially deduct it. You can earn it back, but
just for a few days.
You'll have to work for it.
Anything that you could do to me, I did 10 times worse to myself. Trust me. I was like, oh my God, what's happening to me? All right. We had a listener named Micah Wood write in and say, hi, Jay. This is just a complete guess. Is it the noise that an airplane flight recorder makes to help people find it? I heard water noises, and that's where my brain went straight to. I think this is a really cool guess. I think that those black boxes, which happen to be orange, by the way, send a radio signal. I don't think that they're sending those types of signals, and I don't want to give it away until I reveal the whole thing. But that's a cool guess. The next listener's name was Dan Lee, and Dan said, Dear Jay, it's a hydrophone or a microphone recording a piece of metal being struck and dipped in water. And then he said, I once saw a jazz drummer do this with a microphone and a bucket of water and a metal disc on a string. So no, that's not it. That's cool. I've never heard that. So I can't say how much it resembles that sound. And I think it's very interesting that someone used this type of sound for music. Very interesting. That was not it though. And then, you know, every once in a while, Visto Tutti, my Roman warrior, I don't know who or what this guy looks like, but I think I just love his name. He said, assuming it's a cetacean, I'll say it's a porpoise.
It's on purpose.
I did it on purpose. The veritable bottlenose dolphin of sonar to produce such echolocation. Really cool guess. Not correct, but I really liked it because mammals do make some types of noises like that. So here's the winner from last week. Jonathan Tyndall said, Jay, is this what a submarine's active sonar ping sounds like as heard by a diver while underwater? Yes, you are correct.
Oh, it was sonar. There you go.
It was sonar. Yeah, and it was a scuba diver. I deliberately picked this one because Kara said, can you please just pick something that is the thing? Now, it doesn't completely sound like the sonar we're used to because that's what it sounds like underwater, number one. And the number two response to this is because the sonar you hear in the movies is fake.
In what way?
Just like so many, like, you know, what is it? You're not hearing a bald eagle. You're hearing a hawk scream in the movies.
Right,
in the movies, that's not sonar, which I hate because I'm programmed by people in Hollywood. But
I know, right?
Yeah, that's it.
That's not the absolutely. Sound that a bald eagle makes. That is a red-tailed hawk. But that's the sound they play whenever a raptor flies by.
Next thing you'll tell me that the Enterprise doesn't make all that noise in space.
But at some point, and this is why I found it fascinating to bring up Ben Burtt, because he made all these sound effects that we have, you know, most of us are aware of, and some of us have fallen in love with in the Star Wars movies, right? So you have all the lightsaber and all that stuff. You know, these sound effects sink in to our collective consciousness, and they're cultural, right? Because I'm sure the same sound effects, you know, some are shared around the world, but I'm sure that there's different ones for different cultures. If any listener has an example of this, please let me know. I'm fascinated by that. But they, you know, they shape our world too, because, you know, when I hear that fake movie eagle sound, it is so eagle to me. It is an eagle in my brain, sunken all the way down to my lizard brain. That's what an eagle sounds like. And it's wrong, right, guys?
Correct.
And it's, you know, it's interesting to hear Steve kind of like not like that either, because our reality is partly being shaped, largely, I would say, by the media that we consume.
But what gets me, though, is that, you know, many, many times on some level, somebody, you know, involved in making that TV show or that movie or whatever decides, I'm going to use the wrong noise because that's the noise people associate with this thing. You know what I mean? It's like we're using a language with the viewer, even though it's wrong.
But it's been developed, Steve. It is a legitimate language because it actually does successfully communicate the things that they want to. That's the art of film.
Yeah, but it's also a bit self-fulfilling. Like, why can't you? You could change it, though, if you had the courage to do so, right?
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, but I mean, it's the difference between taking a risk or, you know, like, you got to think, like, they use the Wilhelm scream because it's an effective scream. And as much as like,
yeah, but that's inconsequential though. I like it when movies go meta, like when movies point out the trope and correct it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I've seen examples.
Like the
of that.
Person in the movie is confused over the trope. Like, what's that noise? That's not a submarine? I thought they sounded like this. No, that's in the movies, you know?
That is awesome. I would totally do that.
Can't believe everything you see in Hollywood.
Hey, guys, how about the nerve of a sound person to say, oh, that's just in the movies, and they don't use the real sound. They use yet another fake sound.
Playing a prank on us.
Oh, boy.
But, this is a fascinating topic because it goes very deep. It's not a shallow pool of things. Like, so many things are not what they seem, not the sounds that you think it is, not the flavor that you it's just all these things have been, fed to us. That's why, skepticism, man, it's the only thing that sharpens the glass that you look through, By the way, that was sent in by Charlie Ross. Thank you, Charlie, very much. Charlie's a friend of the show. He's a patron and just a great guy. Every time I bring him up, I smile because he's a really good guy. Anyway, let's go on to the new noise this week. This noisy was sent in by a listener named Marcus Johansson. And I got to say that Marcus, I sent him an email back and he said, I've been a listener for a few weeks now and I can't really stress how much I enjoy Who's That Noisy, even though I've only gotten it right once. It was the La La Dog and it always cracks me up. That freaking La La Dog has connected me with so many listeners,
really?
I can't tell you. Because if anybody, I don't know, Bob, there must be people that like it but didn't tell me, but it just seems to me like every week somebody's like, oh, here's a noisy. Oh my God, that La La Dog, that is the best damn noisy. Like somebody throws a comment at me about it. That's the noisy, man.
Yeah.
That is the noisy of all noisies, I think. La la.
La la
la la. La. Oh my God, it still cracks me up.
All right, Jay, so if people missed it and they're like, what are they talking about? How do they find that video? What do they search for?
This is why
for?
I love the internet. Just type in la 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 dog.
That's it.
La,
yep,
la,
that's it.
La,
I love, yep.
Dog. Let's see what comes up. And there it is. It's actually at the – well, wait. Now, Google changes for every person. It's at the top
there
of my
is.
Google.
Of course it is.
Might not be
dog.
For yours.
Yeah.
But you'll see a really weird-looking dog. Press the play button if that's what you see because it's very funny. Okay. So Marcus sent in an awesome noisy. I'm going to play for you right now.
My first thought, Jay, was something about the Bellerophon from Forbidden Planet or a sound effect in that movie.
Cool. We are hardwired as brothers together. I know exactly when in the movie. It's the music.
Yes.
It was actually the music when the creature is invisible walking on the ship. And you're hearing, I guess that's supposed to be the noises of the ship or the music, but that, yeah, totally.
All right,
it's
cool.
It's really just a background sci-fi noise. That's really all it is.
All right, so guys, if you think you know what this noisy is, please email me. And if you also heard something really cool like that noisy I just played, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. One quick question this week. This one comes from Eric from Omaha, Nebraska. And Eric writes, I'm no expert, but I smell bullshit. He's referring to transcranial magnetic stimulation and depression. And then he writes, always love the show. Thank you. So what do you guys think? TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation as a treatment for depression. Bullshit or reasonable?
I say definitely reasonable, for sure. I've read too many good things about
spectrum,
that.
Spectrum, yeah. Yeah, I think haven't we actually talked about magnetic fields? And
yeah, we've talked about TMS before. Yeah, so here's the thing, and the reason why I wanted to answer Eric's email is that there's so much magnetism-based health quackery and pseudoscience out there that it does give you this knee-jerk reaction that any intervention that claims to work through magnetic fields is bullshit till proven otherwise. That's not a bad heuristic. It's a good first approximation. Yep. But you can't stop there because there are legitimate, electromagnetic treatments in medicine. And this is one of them. TMS is a perfectly legitimate treatment for major depression. This is called neuromodulation, right? There's a number of treatments that count as neuromodulation. They include electroconvulsive therapy. Remember that going back to the 50s, 40s? What is that? One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Yeah.
Transcranial magnetic stimulation, vagus nerve stimulation, right? Those are the three that are currently reasonably evidence-based and in use. So of those, the most effective is electroconvulsive therapy, but it also has the worst side effects, cognitive and cardiovascular. So
really?
They keep
too?
Evolving the procedure to get less and less severe, right? So that their side effects are less. It's like, how gently can we do this and still get the benefits without causing the horrible side effects? And so that's evolved quite a bit, you know, over the last 20, 30 years. And then transcranial magnetic stimulation really is just a continuation of that process. It's like, can we get the same effect without even really causing a seizure or using an electric shock, just by using a magnetic field that was more focused? And the answer is yes, but TMS is not as effective as ECT. It's still effective. It's definitely effective for depression, but there's two populations of particular interest. One is treatment-resistant depression, people who have depression that is resistant to medication or talk therapy. That is the population where ECT is mainly used, treatment-resistant depression, but also in psychotic depression, because it's like the very, very severe form, and also in depression in the elderly, because they have a lot of difficulty with medication. So those would be three populations where it would be nice if we could have a neuromodulation approach. And again, ECT is effective, but it's kind of heavy-handed. So we have TMS and also vagus nerve stimulation. And there's a lot of new ones being developed. There is electrically administered seizure therapy, transcutaneous vagal nerve stimulation, and transcranial direct current stimulation, as well as deep brain stimulation. So these are all promising new treatments for depression. DBS, deep brain stimulation, is a proven therapy for other things like neurological stuff, movement disorders, etc. So this is all part of this new paradigm of neurological, you know, neuropsychological treatments, where, you know, the brain is an electrical organ, right? The signals are electrical. And so we could use electrical or magnetic fields in order to modulate brain function. Why wouldn't that work? You know, pharmacological modulation is actually pretty crude, you know, by comparison.
And that's chemical modulation, right? This is, because the brain is electrochemical.
Yeah, exactly. Or just biological, right? It could just be biological manipulation, not dependent on the specific functionality of the brain. But yeah, anything that affects neurotransmitters is neurotransmitter or neurochemical modulation. And that's inherently limited by evolution, right? By how specific the receptors are and the distribution of those neurotransmitters and the receptor subtypes, et cetera. You can't get more focused, more specific than the brain is, right? And so there's a lot of off-target effects when you're using chemical modulation in the brain, just because of that fact. But with neuromodulation, it's only limited by our technology. You know, we could stimulate one neuron if we had the precise enough technology. There is no inherent limit, which is why I think as this technology advances, it's going to be a pretty exciting a field for the future. We're still really in its infancy. There are proven therapies, approved therapies. TMS for depression is actually one of them. But we've got a long way to go in terms of really dialing in this technology, literally.
Well, where do you see it, Steve? Where do you see it in, like, you know, 20, 30 years? Give me some advanced application.
It's hard to say because you don't know, like, what the, especially clinically, because we don't know what the ultimate clinical effects are going to be. But I think absolutely we will be using electrical nerve stimulation, using some kind of neuromodulation, electrical or magnetic neuromodulation, for I think any movement disorder, certainly for seizures, basically stopping seizures in their tracks, I think is a likely application. Already there's some research there. And anything affecting mood, perception, even cognition.
Ooh, baby.
There's a lot of potential there.
Imagine that.
Okay, we're going to do a name that logical fallacy also this week. So this email comes from Jeffrey from California. And he writes, "Hi, I love the show. I've been listening for years. I own a hard copy and a digital copy of the book, and I recently became a patron." Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thanks, man.
"I recently noticed a common logical fallacy that I can't make fit into the logical fallacies you have defined. I call it the election fallacy." So listen to this, guys, and you tell me what you think is going on here. This is actually a little complicated. Here's an example of how the election fallacy plays out. "I love hummingbirds. They sparkle like flying jewelry, and they're a miracle of nature. A candidate for governor, Janet Humming, also loves hummingbirds and proposes making the hummingbird the California state bird as part of her election platform. A new governor gets elected, and sadly for me, Janet Humming lost the election. My conclusion, here's the fallacy, everyone who voted for the winning candidate hates hummingbirds and wants the quail to remain the California state bird. I've seen, this is all fake, by the way, it's just a hypothetical. I've seen this play out a lot in politics lately. I think many people who succumb to this fallacy fail to realize that most people probably agree with them. Who doesn't think hummingbirds are cool? It was a difference of priority, not principle, that led others to vote for the other candidate. They may have wanted to see the hummingbird become the state bird too, but they considered other issues to be more important when choosing a candidate. So what is the logical fallacy of assuming that someone who voted against the candidate who's pro-hummingbird must hate hummingbirds?
It's not hasty generalization, is it?
True, sort of. Not a generalization. It is a hasty something, but not a generalization.
Is it like a false attribution?
I mean, you're kind of nibbling around the edges. So it's a non sequitur, right? It's all the vague things, but is there something really super specific to exactly the logic that's being used in there? I'll give you a hint. There's actually a formal logical fallacy in there.
Formal?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Here's the formal logical fallacy. So remember, an informal logical fallacy may or may not be valid depending on context. Like, it's okay sometimes to appeal to authority when the authority is appropriate, but not when it's overstating their authority. But if something is always wrong, always, always, always not valid, that's usually a formal logical fallacy. It has to be wrong by its very construction.
Right.
So here's the formal fallacy. It's affirming the consequent.
Oh.
Affirming the consequent. Sometimes called the converse error. That's saying, if my lamp breaks, my room will be dark, right? That's true. That's a valid statement. My room is dark, therefore my lamp must be broken. It's like, no, it ignores the fact that there could be other reasons why your room is dark other than your lamp being broken, like somebody may have flipped the light off. Or the bulb is dead, but not the lamp. Or somebody borrowed the bulb or whatever. There's like all kinds of things that could happen. Mm. So here it's like, I guess you could say, if you don't like hummingbirds, you will vote against this candidate. You voted against this candidate, you must not like hummingbirds.
It's
the same thing. It's like, no, it doesn't work both ways because there's lots of other reasons that your lamp could be off, or there's lots of other reasons that somebody might have voted against your candidate. It could be a matter of priority. It could be that they just don't care about hummingbirds. They could think that they might like quails and want that to be the state bird. Whatever, there's lots of other things going on. You can't assume the consequent from that. It's also the fallacy of the single cause in a way. So it's assuming a single cause or reducing a complex issue or a complex case to one thing, and that holds with elections. There may be tons of policy and personality and other reasons why somebody might be for or against a candidate, and assuming it's one issue, the one issue you care about, is the fallacy of the single cause. So that's happening as well. There's also, of course, once you attribute it to other people, it becomes a straw man, right? You're using these other fallacies to create a straw man of their position by assuming you must hate hummingbirds. So that's in there as well. Make sense?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. And it does happen.
Yep. Yep. No, totally.
So what you're saying is you don't like hummingbirds?
Right. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. No theme this week, just three news items. You guys ready?
Ready.
Yeah.
All right. Item number one, an analysis of indoor air finds that commercial jet passenger cabins have the worst quality with the highest recorded levels of particulates. All right, number two, a new economic study finds that the externalized costs of the energy and transportation sectors equals almost $25 trillion per year, or more than 28% of the global gross domestic product. And item number three, scientists report the first ever observation of a space hurricane, a hurricane in Earth's upper atmosphere. Bob, go first.
All right, so let's go with the first one here, commercial jet air quality. I mean, I can kind of see that. I mean, aren't they just pulling air from just outside the cabin? I mean, if you're flying in any sort of polluted area, I mean, they've got filters and stuff, but worst quality, I mean, I don't know. Let's look at the next one here. The externalized costs of energy and transportation sectors. Yeah, I mean, I don't. $25 trillion sounds like a lot, but I mean, I've heard other estimates over the years of like, you know, what things really cost, like oil, like the cost of oil. You know, if you factor in like the deaths, you know, of people because of you know, fossil fuels and the cost of like, say, escorting an oil tanker through on its trip, and you just put all that together, it makes it far less competitive. Than against almost, you know, against solar or other ones. It's just so much more money when you look at the whole picture, the whole general sort of mishmash, if you will. So I can kind of buy that one here, although this is like, you know, this could go in so many different directions. I don't know. Let's see. Scientists report the first ever space hurricane, huh? In the upper Earth's atmosphere. Sure. I mean, it's not, I mean, it's upper Earth's atmosphere. There's not much actual atmosphere going on, but there's plasma, there's magnetic fields, there's some anything that has and some sort of a cyclonic action. You would say it's a hurricane in space, so that's possible. So yeah, that one seems reasonable. All right, I'm gonna say that the air quality in jets is the worst. Is a fiction, I guess. The other two seemed reasonable.
Okay, Jay.
All right, so. That's funny you say that, Bob, because I was thinking that one was science, and I'll tell you why. I mean, I know that airplanes have HEPA filters. I know that they're pulling air from outside. And then I'm thinking, like, you know, how high up does pollution get? Is the air more polluted down near, you know, ocean level or, you know, hundreds of feet? Or is it how polluted is it at, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 feet? And I tend to think it would be less polluted up there because the particles are heavier. Unless the plane itself is giving off something that is bad, like the plastics in the plane or something like that. But I'm thinking that's science. Yeah, I'm thinking that space hurricanes, you know, it sounds like a big dramatic thing, but it's basically a hurricane that happens in the upper atmosphere. You know, like calling it a hurricane because it's not like what we really think of as a hurricane that we understand. But sure, there's weather that happens up there. And if they want to classify something as a hurricane in the upper atmosphere, you know, I don't see why that's a problem. I just don't like them using the same word. So that's why I'm going to say that I think number two, the one about the energy and transportation sectors, is the fiction, not because I have any profound insight, just because I think the other two are science.
And Evan?
So I'll go in reverse order. The observation of the space hurricane, I think that one is science. I think hurricane is defined as the formation, but the wind speed involved probably defines it. You know, why they haven't observed it before, I think, is probably the most interesting part of that. You'd think we'd have detected that before, but first ever. That's cool. So I'm not surprised. I think that one's science. I think the economic study one is science as well. I mean, these are extreme numbers we're talking about. You know, you're talking about $25 trillion per year, 28% of the global gross domestic product. But as Bob said, we are talking about energy. We're talking about transportation. These sectors are just, you know, enormous. Bigger than we probably even realize as lay people when it comes to this stuff. So I think that one's right, which means the commercial jet passenger cabins, worst air quality. You would think that, yes, that has some obvious reasons why that would be, but you have to think about what other indoor environments could be worse. I mean, you could have basements, you could have another subterranean areas which may have much greater problems with air and airflow and exchanging of the air due to, you know, when you're in an airplane, you have access to the entire outside. So I have a feeling that that's the trick one. There's for it's the fiction.
All right. So you all agree on the third one. So we'll start there. Scientists report the first ever observation of a space hurricane, a hurricane in Earth's upper atmosphere. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yeah.
This is cool.
Yeah,
I haven't. Why first ever?
Yeah, that the first it's ever remarkable. Is the surprising part. Not that there's space hurricanes, though the name is cool. So Bob's right. Yeah, it's mostly plasma and magnetic fields and stuff up there. But they have a lot of energy, and they could get into patterns at like a tropical storm or a hurricane. But I guess they're just so wispy is why it was hard to observe them.
But Steve, what is it actually that's classifying it as a hurricane? Is it the size?
The size and the pattern and the speed and the energy, all those features.
Okay. All those things.
Mm. Yeah. And they said this is important because for exoplanet studies, because a lot of exoplanets probably have similar conditions and may also have upper atmosphere space hurricanes.
Yeah, but probably pretty hard to detect them if we just found their planet
from here till we get that solar lens right now. All right, let's go back to number one. An analysis of indoor air finds that commercial jet passenger cabins have the worst quality with the highest recorded levels of particulates. Bob and Evan, you think this one is a fiction. Jay, you think this one is science. And this one is,
say it,
the fiction.
Yeah,
fiction,
baby.
Oh. I'm just not doing it this year.
So, yeah, this is,
Jay,
I
was
going to
say the same thing if I lost.
Because you could kind of go both ways. There's a lot of people crammed in there. It kind of smells weird in those planes. And you could easily think that there's got to be something going on there. But actually, what they found was that the commercial jet cabins had the lowest level of particulates. They actually have the cleanest air. And Jay, you mentioned all the reasons why that's the case. They're high up. They're pulling in air from the outside. They got lots of filters. You know, the airline industry is highly motivated to keep stuff out of the air because that's weight. It may not seem like much, but every pound, you know, affects their fuel consumption. So that's why they were pretty happy to remember, you know, in the, what was it, the 90s when the culture shifted and we started banning smoking on planes.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
That was so amazing. I had
ashtrays. Little ashtrays in the armrest. Remember those? Shifted. Oh my gosh.
Oh man, I hate that. Yeah, the you're in a non-smoking row, but the row in front of you is smoking. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, you're in a tube.
And that, but you know, just the particulate matter from cigarette smoke would weigh a lot. It was a lot of weight and actually affected, you know, the amount of fuel that planes have to use. They were happy to ditch the cigarette smoking. Yeah, so the air is very clean. But what it is extremely dry. It is dry, literally as dry as the Sahara Desert. Because the higher you go, the lower the humidity in the air. And so they don't humidify the air. They like it dry, too, because they don't want moisture getting into the seats and everything. Again, adding weight. So the dry works for them. That's why you have to hydrate when you're on a plane. And the longer the flight, the higher they go, the drier the air. On international flights, it is bad. You really, really have to, you know, put on chapstick or lipstick. You have to bring fluid with you and, you know, keep well hydrated. That means that a new economic study finds that the externalized costs of the energy and transportation sectors equals almost $25 trillion per year, or more than 28% of the global gross domestic product. That is science. This is amazing. Of course, you know, this is one study. You know, you try it and there's a lot of estimation going on, but I suspect they're probably not off by an order of magnitude, right? And what they mean by externalized cost, it just means a cost borne by someone other than the people involved, right? The person who is selling the product, the person who's buying the product. It's externalized onto somebody who involuntarily, onto somebody else. So in this case, like if your health is adversely affected by the pollution of somebody else burning fossil fuel, that's an externalized cost. So it's a lot of healthcare costs, a lot of lost lives, lost productivity. And like one of you guys mentioned, like there's a lot of incidental costs and all of that adds up. But so we knew that, right? We knew that there was a lot of externalized costs. We talk about a lot, but just the magnitude of it, more than a quarter of gross domestic product. Think about that. That's a massive subsidy. We are subsidizing energy and transportation to the tune of $25 trillion a year globally. In addition to their direct subsidies, you know, like here's money. You know, there's the allowing them to externalize costs like that is a form of subsidy. The economists estimate that if the producers, the people who are profiting off of this, were accountable for all of the externalized costs, that coal, for example, would cost twice as much as it does.
Yes.
Right?
Speak it.
Which,
wow.
You know, and then this is the thing where you know, politically, it's very interesting because I hear people say, oh, if we did this, it would double the cost of gasoline, as if it's a great thing or as if it's a horrible thing, right? Depending on your perspective, if you are, if you're looking at it through the narrow lens of short-term economic effects, then it could be like, yeah, it'd be horrible for the economy. It's like, well, it's already horrible for the economy. This is just a hidden cost versus a more overt cost. You're still paying. The thing is, you don't think you're paying for it, but you are. You're paying that extra whatever, $2 or $3 a gallon, just not at the pump. You're paying for it in higher health insurance, in higher costs elsewhere, in lost productivity, in lost opportunities. You are paying for it. But and people who are would be happy to have the prices increased. So first of all, it's fair because then you know the people who are profiting are the ones who are paying the cost. And two, it actually makes green energy more cost effective, right?
Yes.
How cost competitive, cost effective would zero carbon energy be if we had to directly pay the externalized costs of fossil fuel, for example?
Suddenly knock it off the page.
Yeah, it's already good. Like solar and wind energy is already competitive. It would be massively more competitive. And also, you know, there is a direct correlation between, for example, the efficiency of the cars people buy and the cost of gasoline. When gas prices go up, people buy more fuel efficient cars. When gas prices are low, people buy huge cars because they don't care. And so allowing the price of gasoline to go up and cover some of that externalized cost would in fact be a huge incentive, you know, to burn less gasoline, to have more fuel efficient cars. Right. Plus, there's that whole global warming thing, you know, about.
On top of all of it.
This would be true without global warming. Global warming is just makes it 10 times worse. Yeah. So one of the most effective things we can do to combat global warming might be to account for these externalized costs. That's it.
Well, isn't that what the.
That's what the carbon tax is all about.
Green tax, carbon tax.
That's what the carbon tax is all about. Yep. All right. Well, good job, Bob and Evan. Thought that was a little tricky.
Wow.
Yeah, Jay, you know.
Jay, good effort.
Hey, win some, you lose some.
Yes, good effort, Jay.
You lose some, you lose some.
You get a consolation prize.
Thank you. Remember the consolation prize? Oh, my God.
You get a constellation prize.
Constellation prize. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Nothing in science has any value to society if it is not communicated, and scientists are beginning to learn their social obligations. And that was written by Anne Roe, R-O-E, her book, The Making of a Scientist, in 1953.
Pretty amazing.
Sort of foretelling the future a bit. And obviously, there was a disturbing lack of that occurring in the middle of the 20th century. The fact that science was, you know, these black box operations in which people had no idea what kind of really the general population had no idea how the heck a lot of these things worked or what was going on. And it's become so important. We take it for granted nowadays, you know, 2021. I mean, we see science everywhere. It's being communicated thoroughly in a lot of places. But back then it was sorely lacking. And she called for the need to pay attention to this, that scientists have to discuss with the public exactly what is going on. It's too important for society to not know what value science has and how it's making things improve in people's lives.
I have a slightly different perspective. I mean, I agree with what you just said, but she's talking specifically about scientists. I think SciComm has come a long way, and there's a lot of good science communication going on. But I think 70 years later, she would be disappointed in the culture of scientists communicating to the public. I think we haven't come nearly as far. You know, and it's amazing to read about this 70 years ago saying, you know, finally scientists are starting to catch on. Really? A lot of them still haven't. Even 70 years later.
A lot of them still haven't, but there's been this whole branch of science communication, a specialty almost unto itself.
Yeah, but and largely, in which, and so a lot of it independent of actual like scientists and academics, you know?
Sure, but some of it has come from people who were scientists. Some of it. There are examples. It's a hybrid, right, Jim?
Yeah, it's a hybrid. No, it's definitely better, but it's just not nearly where it should be, in my opinion.
And we've talked about this argument before, because the other maybe side of that coin is that, well, if the scientists were, you know, more concentrating on the communication of what they were doing, they wouldn't be in the lab doing the science work that they had to do. There may be some validity to that.
Well, it's not as, I mean, it's partly a zero-sum game, but it's not, it doesn't take that much effort to build in a little bit more SciComm. And the other thing is, for those who want to do it, you know, give it academic credit and let them. You know, those who have the inclination, the talent, the ability to do it, to, you know, just give it the value that it needs. You know,
absolutely.
Again, look at our society. Look at what we're going through. You don't think that we need to do better in science communication? We absolutely do.
Always. Yeah. We will always have to do better. I don't know that that will ever end.
Yeah. All right. Thank you guys for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. We miss you, Kara.
Yep. We will probably do the live stream yesterday. I know that sounds weird. Yeah, we're still doing the Friday live stream. It's you know going to happen most Fridays, but you know it's we can't guarantee it because it's not locked into our schedule. Yeah, and if we're going to miss a week, we will give you notice. We'll put a message in various locations, including on our website, to let you know. You know, we've done it most, like in the last year, we've done almost every week. It's only missed
a
couple.
Yeah, we hardly missed a week.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it's rare.
It's rare. All right, guys. We'll see you on Friday. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.